please the court. Good afternoon. Jessica West on behalf of Donald Hicks, the defendant appellant in this matter. Your Honors, we've raised three issues on direct appeal. Two of them are speedy trial issues, and I think probably for the purposes of oral argument and probably for the purposes of an opinion, it makes sense to conflate those two. And I'd like to address that issue or those issues here today. I think they have some complexity, especially procedural, and some factual complexity that bears some discussion here. The standard of review with regards to the speedy trial issue has been conceded to be de novo. The issue was preserved. So moving on to the procedural history, it's somewhat complex, and I'd like to just go through it briefly. There was this was a first-degree murder case, a single count. It was a cold case homicide from about 12, 13 years prior. It was originally set for trial in December of 2006, but there was a problem with the receipt of DNA evidence, which is somewhat common in the district court, in that the CBI and the Denver labs are backed up. So the DNA wasn't received until November, and the case was set over until March 19th. There was a speedy trial deadline in May, the middle of May, May 14th. Between December and March, there were some communications between defense counsel and the prosecution. That's because there were a number of witnesses out of state from Idaho who had never been endorsed. And defense counsel wrote to, and it's attached to the motions for sanctions, wrote to the prosecution and said, clearly, none of the Idaho witnesses, with the exception of maybe one or two, were endorsed. I'm assuming that's intentional. If you intend to endorse these Idaho witnesses, the defense needs to know, because there's a very cumbersome out-of-state subpoena process, and it's going to be difficult to locate these witnesses. They were transient. All that's set out in the record. 30 days before trial, and the prosecution responded saying, all of our witnesses have been endorsed. Then 30 days before trial, they file an endorsement that lists 15 Idaho witnesses, and defense counsel files a motion to strike those witnesses. Nowhere and never does defense counsel ask that the case be continued, even as an alternative sanction, asks only that those witnesses be stricken. At a hearing held on the 5th of March, the court heard argument. It was 2 weeks before trial, found a Rule 16 discovery violation, and that the defendant would be prejudiced by allowing the Idaho witnesses, and struck the witnesses. At that time, the prosecution did not ask to continue, did not ask for an alternate sanction, nothing like that. And in fact, when they left the court, as the record indicates, they indicated that they would ask for a Rule 21, that they intended to file an interlocutory appeal on the issue. They did not do that. Instead, a few days later, they filed a motion for the court to reconsider, asking for the different sanction of a continuance chargeable to the prosecution, or in the alternative that the court continue the trial. I'm sorry. A hearing was held on the 13th of March, about 6 days before the trial was scheduled to begin. It had been set over, and at that hearing, the defendant was unable to be present. Hadn't been brought in from the sheriff, couldn't be, and given the timeline, defense counsel indicated that she waived the defendant's appearance. He was not there. It was held in chambers. All the parties assumed it was being recorded. In fact, it wasn't. And the hearing was, the record of that hearing, that March 13th hearing, was reconstructed then in July. At the hearing on the 13th, the reconstructed record shows that there were 62 days remaining on speedy trial. The prosecution asked for an alternative sanction, a lesser sanction, and the court specifically stated that it would continue the trial as a sanction to the prosecution, and that it was, quote-unquote, charging the prosecution with a speedy trial delay.
Now, at this point, Ms. West, the only Idaho witness that they were really fighting about was the informant, correct?
Exactly right. What happened at the very first, the hearing on on March 5th, is that the state said the only witness we really need is this informant. Right. And so it conceded the rest of the argument with regards to all the rest of the witnesses. But the defense indicated that they needed some of the Idaho witnesses. That was the problem, to rebut this informant. At the time the statement was allegedly made to the informant, there were actually others present. So part of the problem was that these people couldn't be made available at that point for the trial date on March 19th. So at that hearing on the 13th, the court specifically stated that it would set the case over as a sanction, charge the prosecution with a speedy trial delay, and then started to go through, and then, you know, went through calendars. There were two defense counsel, and the court was available. The court wasn't exactly sure during the reconstructed record how many dates it made available to defense counsel, but it wasn't an open calendar that the court had. There were, I think the court says, 4 or 5 dates that the court offered to defense counsel. Within the 62 days, exactly.
Actually, it's 4 or 5 weeks the court was available, correct?
That's right. And the court was always scheduled trial to start, I think, on a Tuesday. So it was 4 or 5 Tuesdays that the court was offering for, as a day to set. To set the trial. And there was not one of those 4 or 5 dates that both of the defense counsel were present. So defense counsel asked, because the defendant was adamant throughout that he didn't want a continuance and that he was unwilling to waive speedy trial. So the defense counsel asked for substitute alternate defense counsel to be appointed.
Ms. West, one thing that was not clear to me from reading the briefs was whether the defense counsel asked for substitution of only one of the defense counsel and the appointment of only one substitute counsel so that the trial could still be held within the speedy trial time period.
And that's because, Your Honor, that you're absolutely accurate. But the record was unclear about that, and it was defense counsel's representation that that's what she had said and that's what she intended. And the court's recall that, in fact, defense counsel had gone through their calendar separately, and that one of the defense counsel was available sometimes, but the other one wasn't. So whether or not it was specifically requested, it was clear in the course of the hearing that there were times when, let's say, lead counsel was available but co-counsel wasn't, or co-counsel was available but lead counsel wasn't.
But as I understand it from what you're saying, if I'm inferring correctly, the defendant, at least the reconstructed record, does not show us that defense counsel asked expressly that only one of the defense counsel be replaced.
It was defense counsel recollection that she did, and the court did not recall that. That's correct.
Okay, so then the answer to what I said is yes, if I understand you correctly.
I would say that the record was unclear.
But I understand your point that the record is unclear, but when a record is reconstructed, aren't we bound by the reconstruction of the record by the trial court?
Well, that's interesting, because the way that that the reconstruction hearing actually took place is that that each counsel set out what they recalled. There were two defense counsels, one prosecutor, and then the court. But it wasn't as though the court made findings per se with regards to what had happened. That said, it was certainly requested that counsel be that new counsel be appointed. And this is a situation that's probably strictly a problem with ADC counsel. And that's because were the defendant represented by a public defender, they could internally have found other defense counsel to represent the defendant within speedy trial. Were there a private counsel, the same thing could have happened without the permission of the court. But with appointment by alternate defense counsel, a substitution needs to be court-ordered. And the court here refused to do that.
Well, I think, wasn't the court very concerned? This was a cold murder case. And in fact, defense counsel below made a lot of, I don't mean negative, but made a lot of noise about, you know, hey, we're really prejudiced here that we got all these witnesses with 62 days left. And now on appeal, essentially saying the court should have appointed substitute counsel, and they could have been ready with 62 days left, even though the defense lawyers who were there said they couldn't be ready.
Right.
And the court said, you know, I find that ironic, I think was the word the court used, and it said, I'm not going to find counsel could be ready on the cold murder cases.
Sure. And let me respond this way. When defense counsel contacted the district attorney to find out who the witnesses would be, that was early January, the case was set in March and there were approximately 60 days. The sole issue was the issue of out-of-state subpoenas and the time that it takes for that. Aside from that, everything had been prepared. All the pretrial work had been done, all the motions work had been done, and all that needed to be done, really, was to try the case, really. And especially in a circumstance like here where the defense counsel wasn't laboring under a conflict, could have assisted alternate counsel, either one or both, could have assisted alternate counsel in becoming prepared. Not only that, but the counsel did indicate that, in her opinion, someone could be ready in 62 days. That's very different from receiving a list of out-of-state subpoena, a bull, witnesses with less than 30 days to trial.
How do you distinguish, Ms. West, the various Supreme Court cases that say the court should impose the narrowest sanction, and there are cases that say where a continuance can resolve the problem, even in the middle of the trial, the court should do that. I mean, why didn't the sanction here of a continuance, I mean, the issue is don't have enough time to do subpoenas, don't have enough time to prepare cross. Why doesn't the continuance solve that, the prejudice to the defendant?
Well, I think it's important to notice that this was a sanction against the prosecution. Willful or not, their behavior had misled defense counsel. It's not a circumstance where, and most of the time, defense counsel comes forward and says that there is some reason that they need a continuance. That was not here. This was a circumstance where the defendant suffered as a result of a sanction against the prosecution. They were ready to go to trial. And defense counsel had relied on representations, intentional or not, regarding witnesses. So I think it's distinguishable in those regards. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may, for rebuttal.
Sure. You have 1 minute and 20 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, and may it please the court, John Lee on behalf of the people, registration number 38141. I'd like to start off kind of where this court was headed. I think the only cognizable claim on appeal based on the record is that the defendant raised the claim below that the trial court should try and replace both counsel. And I think the record's uncontroverted. That would have been unreasonable given the fact that this was a 13-year-old homicide case with evidence coming in from different states, that appointing substitute counsel for both counsel in that instance, it would have seriously jeopardized the defendant's right to effective representation.
Mr. Lee, let me ask you a couple of questions to follow up on the questions I was asking Ms. West about the reconstruction of the record. She told us that the defense counsel's recollection was that their request for substitute counsel included substituting just one of the trial counsel. Is that consistent with your understanding of what was said at the reconstruction hearing?
If I remember correctly, Your Honor, I think defense counsel asserted that was their intention. I don't think they went so far to say that they, in fact, made that representation, but in fact, it was their intention to do so. And as far as the court and the people were concerned, the defendant didn't make that argument. The only request they made was for both counsel to be replaced, not just one single counsel.
And Ms. West also said that Judge Hoffman didn't make findings, so to speak, in reconstructing the record. Is that an accurate statement?
The court didn't explicitly say I'm making these findings. I agree to that extent, but the court did state exactly what it thought had happened. And in that regard, with what we have here, the court remembered that counsel did not make that representation. The court went on to further find that even if counsel had, it would have been inappropriate in this case, given.
That counsel had not made what representation?
If counsel had made the request for just one counsel to be replaced, it still would have been inappropriate given the complexity of this case.
Okay.
Turning to just to address the legal issues, because I'm not sure, just going through the briefs, whether the defendant's argument adequately grapples either with the Supreme Court's holding in Gallagher or with other decisions we have which establish the framework for addressing situations such as what we have here. As at the threshold, this is not a case where the trial court had to substitute counsel. That's exactly the problem the Supreme Court faced in Gallagher, where because of a conflict of interest, the trial court had to substitute counsel. And I think that's the predicate condition for the holding in that case, where our Supreme Court held that the trial court in that case violated the defendant's statutory right to speedy trial because when really, for no reason at all, it appointed the defendant counsel who was unable to try that case within speedy. But there's simply nothing in Gallagher which imposes an absolute duty on trial courts to try and substitute counsel to avoid speedy trial deadlines when counsel does not need to be substituted.
Didn't the court, Mr. Lee and Gallagher, also express some concern about the inadequacy of the findings by the trial court? I agree with you. There was an issue of conflict, and the court focused on the fact that, you know, you got to replace counsel anyway. Why don't you try to find somebody who could do it? But I think there was also, and you can correct me if I'm misremembering, something about an inadequacy of findings. And my memory is the court made at least some findings that it didn't think anyone could be ready within the speedy trial time in Gallagher. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think in Gallagher they were not justified by the record. So the court made a conclusory statement, I believe, this is at least what I can gather from the opinion, that they were going to appoint that counsel, and it was the court's assumption that given the time frame, there was no way counsel could be prepared to proceed in trial. But I think if we look at the crimes involved in the cases, this case presents a very different set of facts. That case was a child abuse case. This is a 13-year-old murder case, made even more complex by the fact that we have evidence coming in from another state. And so I think the record here, and the trial court did make this finding, is supported by the record, that given how complex this case was, the difficulty of the case, it would have been unreasonable to expect someone to try this case within 60 days cold.
So you would distinguish Gallagher in this case. Here we had more specific fact findings that were supported by the record. That's the distinction you're making?
Indeed. Okay. And I think if we look at Gallagher, that makes all the difference in the world. And the fact in Gallagher, it was an inclusory statement, not buttressed either by the record or any of the findings made by the court. Unless this court has any other further questions.
Let me ask you, if I can, to address the principal speedy trial issue that I understand Ms. West to be making, which was the delay here really was on the prosecution, and I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that. I mean, it was all kinds of discovery violations, willful or not, and the court found violations, and ultimately resulted in the case getting kicked on speedy trial. As I understand Ms. West's argument, it's, you know, this shouldn't be on the defendant. How do you respond to that?
Two examples to that, Your Honor, and this court and our Supreme Court just simply haven't drawn that line. First, for example, in Wilson, a case coming out of this court, at first cut, we have a very comparable case. In that case, the court and defense counsel were ready to proceed to trial within speedy. The trial court, because of its own scheduling conflict, has to switch the date, but yet still has a date within speedy. So again, we have a trial change, non-attributable to the defendant, but like here in Wilson, defense counsel was unavailable for that new date. The trial court charges the continuance to the defendant given that factual circumstance, and this court affirms. says it was chargeable to the defendant. More on point, Duncan, a case after Gallagher, a Supreme Court case. In that case, our Supreme Court explicitly rejected that argument. They held that absent bad faith from the prosecution, should a case be continued either by request by the defendant or presumably due to unavailability of defense counsel, then it's only chargeable to the defendant. It's not chargeable to the people, it's not chargeable to the court, unless there's bad faith. And here, I don't think the record supports finding bad faith.
Well, let's say you have this situation, we've got the discovery abuse, but instead of 62 days remaining in speedy trial, there were two, or one. And the court says, we have one other day, we could try this tomorrow, we have to kick it, and the defendant's not available in that one day. Does, in your view, that gets attributable to the defendant, even as long as there's no bad faith by the prosecutor?
Strictly applying Duncan, yes. But I think in the context of this case, that makes an excellent point. And the fact that the people were ready to proceed within speedy trial, despite discovery sanctions, the people were available to try the defendant's case. And I think that very fact militates against a finding of bad faith. Because when we're looking at bad faith in the speedy context, it's were the people actively trying to circumvent the defendant for being tried within speedy. Here, even with the discovery violations, the people were available to try the defendant within speedy. So I think given the fact of the record here, that just emphasizes the fact that there was no bad faith and a continuance was chargeable to the defendant. And if the court has no further questions, I'd ask you to affirm the judgment below. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Your Honor, very briefly, obviously. First of all, this case would be different if the court had picked up the telephone and called the Office of the Alternate Defense Counsel and received a response that it is not possible to find someone. But the court didn't go far enough. And I think Gallagher requires that they do that, that they make an inquiry to see if someone was available. The only defense counsel, the only person who was familiar with what the defense looked like, with what defending murder cases is, indicated that it would be possible. Secondly, regardless of bad faith or not, if what the court does here today is affirm this conviction, despite the speedy trial circumstances here, I think that the court will effectively set out a roadmap in how to evade speedy trial. And that's not what the statute contemplates. Not only that, this case is distinguishable by the fact that you have prosecutorial action and you have what the court referred to as a continuance chargeable to the prosecution. The speedy trial statute is very clear in setting out distinctions between requests for continuance by the defense and requests for continuance by the prosecution. I would ask that the court reverse the conviction in order that the case be dismissed or in the alternative order a new trial.
Thank you very much, Ms. West, for your argument. Thank you again, Mr. Lee. Thank you, Ms. West. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the oral arguments this afternoon for Division 1. So the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.
Court will be in recess, subject to call.